Good afternoon, and welcome to We the People. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff, and we're live.
Bill is focused. He was doing two things at once.
I was catching up here. Hey, our sponsor this hour is Team Power, local John Deere Kubota dealership in Shasta Lake City. They've been closed last couple of days due to the fire here in Redding, but we'll be open for business Monday. They're at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, just off I-5, south of Phil's Propeller. And anything you need done on your tractor, new or used, we can work on it. Full parts and service staff available.
Most days, yeah. Probably got a call first, maybe, for Monday.
Yeah, maybe. Their phone number is 226-9226. And as far as I know, everything's up and ready to go for Monday. You can get them on the web at readingtractors.com.
So, if you are tuning in and it's not whatever day today is, the 29th of July, then this won't make sense. But if it's the 29th of July, we're in the midst of the Carr fire, C-A-R-R fire, out of Redding. So we've had a, I think exciting's the wrong word.
Hectic.
For the past eventful week. Yeah, eventful. How's that? Yeah, it's been really weird. We have traffic at the wrong time of day. I mean, our town's only, if you don't live in the area, our town's 90,000 people. We back up to Whiskeytown National Park. We're surrounded by national forests. And so, we have a lot of vegetation and therefore lots of fire potential. But this burned down into town. And they're talking about over 500 structures. So not necessarily individual homes, but structures. And then 115 damaged. Can't get my computer to come up or I'd actually give you actual numbers.
5,000 threatened homes still at this time.
Oh, Ashley's got it. Well,
and
you tell
they're up to, I think this fire is up to 89,000 acres right now. It's a beast.
We have like zip for containment just because it's all over the place. The firefighters have been doing a great job, but it's been yucky.
And just to give you an idea of how big and how bad this thing is, like Aaron said, we're community of 90,000. And 38,000 have been evacuated. So it's.
And that 38,000 is from before they evacuated the Iga Ono area. So if you're not if you're not in the area, that is south of the fire, but that is a very close community to Redding.
Okay,
so
yeah.
We have even more than that evacuated. We had like three roads allowed to return home so far. The fire is at 5% containment, 89,000 acres. 517 destroyed, 100 structures destroyed, 135 damage, more than 5,000 still threatened.
Yeah, so it's a mess.
And five fatalities, if we haven't mentioned that.
Yes.
Five fatalities so far.
One fireman, a support guy.
Dozer operator.
Who was a dozer operator. They were killed very early in. Creepily enough, we were talking to the police chief yesterday, and his house was basically slurped up in the, you may have seen the fire tornado that's been kind of on the news. If you look up fire tornado, car fire, if you Google that, I'm sure there's a video of it.
We've had several of them. The fire is now massive enough, it's creating its own weather.
Yeah. So the tornado came and ate his house. It also is pulled the one fireman's truck off the ground and flipped it over and he was killed. And great grandmother and her four and 5 year old great grandchildren, they got trapped in the house. The great grandfather went for supplies and, in just that blink of an eye, the fire turned, it came whooshing through. They said there was we heard just on the way out the door, they said it was probably a gas line that blew. So, I mean, if you're in the area, make sure you have your valuable things like the people, pets, things like that. If you have room to house people, they've got all sorts of ways set up that you can help folks. If you can take large animals, that's a huge need.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if you could babysit somebody's dog, that's a big need, too. I was at the shelter Thursday night over at Shasta College,
Which is now at capacity, by the way.
Yeah, which is, it was at capacity that night too, but people were sleeping outside because they couldn't take their pets inside, and the Shasta College Farm didn't have room. You can take animals to Tehama County to the fairgrounds there. They're still accepting animals. But if you have property and you live outside the fire zone,
anywhere west of I-5 right now is being advised. Have your go bag ready. If you have somewhere outside of the area to go, go.
Yeah,
because
go, go
even there. Even if you're not in the evacuation zones, it helps the infrastructure to get people out. Plus, the air is terrible right now.
Yeah.
So if you can get out, get somewhere where you're allowed to breathe, that helped everybody.
And for those of you, I mean, for people that aren't necessarily following all the updates, but you have been evacuated or you're talking to people who've been evacuated and they're frustrated, it's like, well, the fire's not really near me. Why can't we go back? The Shasta County Sheriff Tom Basenko explained yesterday that once they evacuate people, they don't want to, okay, you can go back. Oh, wait, evacuate. Okay, go back, evacuate. Because then if they put out the evacuation, people won't. They won't heed it. So they're trying to.
Well, they have to make sure
be really
all the
judicious
safety
on
issues are addressed before they let people back in.
And there's that.
Even if you're not near the fire, a power line could be down in that area.
Right.
Or you might be out of power for a long time. And with this heat, without air conditioning, that can also be deadly. So there are a lot of factors that they're taking into account. They've said multiple times across several agencies, our highest priority is getting people back in their homes. But they won't let you in until it's safe.
And the good news is that how about this? This is like a good news, bad news. If you're not affected by the fire and you've decided to be a looter during the fire because maybe, you know, you're between gigs and you thought looting seemed like a great idea, you're completely going to prison. That's provided you don't become
fullest extent of the law.
Yeah, there's
felony.
I mean, they've caught a couple of people. So we've got the National Guard here, thanks to them. They're patrolling all the closed roads. And so they're really keeping track of the areas that are closed. It's not like you've abandoned your house and good luck to you. You know, good luck to you. Everybody's really doing a great job. So hearts go out to people who've lost folks and lost homes and all of that. And everybody's really pulling together. It's kind of awesome. So
Other than that, it's...
Other than that, it's been awesome.
Yeah, it's been a great weekend.
Well, you know, the upside is I haven't heard the word Russia in an entire week. It's really funny. Like, Russia just went away. It became a non-issue. So it's interesting. Things like this are very very focusing. But the pictures that are out there, you know, look at Facebook and some of the news channels. Channel 2 out of the Fox Channel 2 out of San Francisco was running a drone early in the fire. And I'll tell you what, this is... something. So, on that happy note, actually, we're talking about rural America today, so actually it is on that happy note. But one of the dangers of living out here is you can't make a living. Your house might burn up. You get, you know, demonized and crushed by policy by people who live in big cities who don't understand. But at the end of the day, people out in the rural areas are the folks who put all your food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
That's where all your food comes from. It doesn't come from a city. And
it doesn't come from the grocery store.
And they don't make meat in the back of the grocery store. Meat runs around on legs. I guess I titled it the other day, but I titled the show The Struggle of Rural America. Apparently, that was fitting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a big struggle this week. Jim Smith is the Siskiyou County Ag Commissioner and Sealer. And at first I was like, Sealer? What does that mean? So I think most people don't even know what a sealer is. So we're going to learn some stuff today. And we should probably take a really quick break before we get Jim going, because then we'll say, okay, Jim, oh, wait, sorry, we have to take a break. So I'll just do that for him, put him out of his misery. When we come back, we're going to speak with Jim Smith out of Siskiyou County. He is our Siskiyou County Ag Commissioner up there. We're going to be discussing the struggle of rural America, and we won't be talking about the fire mostly for the rest of the time. But if you do need updates, go to the Cal Fire site. Check Channel 7, KRCR-TV. They've got a really good live feed up. And we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
back. Okay, we said we weren't talking about the fire, but we have one minor note here because Ashley's been working hard.
So we, on the Free Fire Facebook page, we have been keeping up to date and releasing updates as often as we get them. So if you're having trouble finding a place where all of the information is in one spot, or all of the relevant information, make sure you like us on Facebook and we can get that information out. That is Free Fire Radio on Facebook.
Bonus.
There you go.
Nice. Okay. Now to Jim. Geez, Jim, usually your county's on fire, so, you know. We're like the big show in town. So let's I have a little bit of information about Jim. He grew up on a Tule Lake potato, grain, and hay family farm that his grandfather homesteaded following his service in World War I. Over the years, Jim's earned a bachelor's degree and a master's of science from California State University, Chico. I'm sure there was no fun happening there. I'm sure there were no couches on the lawns. There was no beer being had. None of that was going on when you were there. It was a long time ago. He also has a teaching credentials in the subject areas of agriculture, industrial arts, and science. So he's done all sorts of stuff. Worked on the family farm, went into agriculture and research, and he's now the Siskiyou County Ag Commissioner and Sealer.
Ta-da! Welcome, Jim.
Thank you very much. In defense of the Chico State,
I went to Humboldt. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Well, I gotta tell you a story. It was kind of related to where my father grew up in Chico, and you know, he got married to a young lady from Tule Lake and got kind of conned into becoming a potato farmer up in the cold country. You know. But I had a grandmother and 38 relatives to keep track of me when I was in Chico. So, you know, I had to watch out for that.
Yeah. Probably no drinking on
the
front
lawn. Hard to get out of line with that kind of supervision.
Yep, no drinking, you know, no partying. And the courses that I took in agriculture, the teachers set you down the first day of class at 7 o'clock in the morning. Some of them were 7 o'clock. And they said, this is the ag department. So I don't care what you do all night, but if you're not sitting in our class bright and early in the morning willing to participate and learn something, you're going to flunk. And so they had a little bit of a socialization scheme there where you learned how to socialize at night and also be productive during the day. So they had it all figured out. You know, you didn't get away from that, you know.
It was the olden days. Everybody wasn't going to get a trophy, huh?
No.
No.
Most of us did, though, because the teachers were very caring about your learning environment and the subjects that they were teaching, and they had a vested interest in the success of every kid. And on that note, I would like to discuss that a little bit. It's kind of interesting. The guy that started the ag department at California State University, Chico, as it's known now, Dr. Kendall, president of the college, went out and recruited all the FFA agriculture teachers in the North State to start his ag department at Chico State. And as such, he had teachers that knew how to teach students some of the hardest to teach or encourage to learn students were found in the ag departments at that time. So they were instrumental in setting up a very successful program at Chico State. And California State University Chico has a fantastic agriculture department, and I'd recommend it to anybody thinking about studying that. How about that?
Yeah. I think that's fantastic.
I think that's where my brother went to school and got his degree in ag over there.
And he's a walnut grower.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a lawmaker? Your brother's a lawmaker?
No, he's a walnut grower.
A walnut grower.
He's a walnut maker.
Yeah, he makes walnuts down in Glenn County.
Oh, that's pretty funny. So you gave me a little bit of a description, but I spent about 20 years as a pest control advisor, which is a person that does agricultural consulting work for farmers and ranchers. And I spent most of that, not all of it, in the Sacramento Valley. And I had a lot of walnut growers for customers. A little bit of background as I managed to work my way through college. And I enjoyed working with immensely working with agricultural producers. They're probably some of the best people around. They take humongous risks every year, as you can see with the drought that seems to be encompassing our counties in the North State pretty regularly. And the fires that are attempting to burn everything up, unfortunately. Feel for the people in Redding right now. We went through something similar not too long ago burned up about 80,000 acres up here also, but it was a heck of a lot less settled than what you guys are going through down there. We actually have sent some emergency response people down from my department. I run the animal control, domestic animal control program here in Siskiyou County, and my supervisor and my animal control officers and the volunteers that work to help our department went down to help re-evacuate Haven Humane Society's, you know, shelter because they were evacuated yesterday, I think.
Yeah, it was yesterday.
I haven't got any big updates on that, but it gets pretty hard to deal with massive amounts of people like you guys have had to evacuate and all the animals that are associated with that. So if everybody has a pet or two or three or and a horse out back or, you know, some livestock out in the backyard or in the back, you know, 10 acres, you know, it becomes a nightmare to try to how to deal with those issues.
Well, that was one thing I think a lot of people didn't realize with all the evacuations. They had shelters set up for folks, but most of the shelters didn't take pets. So you had to make arrangements to get your pet someplace else. And it was a real challenge for a lot of folks. And then, like you say, with the livestock, horses, cows, so forth.
I mean, you have trailers, but you don't have a trailer that'll fit necessarily all your livestock in one trip.
Oh, it's multiple trips.
You know, people make multiple trips. So if you're being evacuated.
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a challenge.
Considerations for stuff like that. So your folks, because we're, you know, roughly hour and a half from you, so they're coming down. They're working in the animal control thing. So who runs the stuff up in your county? Do you have, like, volunteers or something?
Who runs the stuff up in my county?
Yeah, who's going to take care of your animal control come Monday?
So we have a short staff, and on the weekends, the sheriff department covers for us, and they also run interference with us when we have, you know, dangerous locations to go visit, which is quite often these days with the advent of some of the cannabis producers. Not all of them, of course, but
we just call them dope growers.
Well. You can call them dope growers. I'm not calling them cannabis growers.
I just wanted people to know what you were talking about.
Okay. Some of them tend to have quite a few pit bulls on the premises, and they become problematic at times. And oftentimes when they leave for the season, the pit bulls are left behind, which creates havoc for my animal control department. But they do a very good job. They're a remarkable bunch, as are our volunteers that stepped up and helped us out a lot during our fires here. So,
yeah, as long as we don't have emergencies at the exact same time, works out well. We come help you, you come help us. It's like, good grief.
Yeah, and I'd hate to be CAL FIRE right now. You know, imagine how spread they are.
Oh, God, they're everywhere.
Yeah, pretty rough.
Hey, so the Ag Commissioner, okay, you wouldn't think the Ag Commissioner would handle animal control necessarily. That's something kind of new. I want to know, what does the sealer do?
The sealer? You want to guess?
Well, I kind of know, but I didn't originally. But I know, so I cheated.
So the sealer, oh, you looked it up. Good for you. Not very many people really understand what the sealer does.
Because I was what's a sealer?
Let's give you a little bit of background. Your listeners in California at least might know, but the California Agriculture Commissioners and sealers are the entities that do regulatory work in the arena of agriculture. And in the case of sealers, they do all the weights and measures regulatory work. For example, if you go buy a gallon of gas at a gas station, and you see a sticker on the gas pump that says it was sealed by the sealer of weights and measures, and it has a year on there, like 2018, it'd be this year, and the color was probably red this year, you know that a county sealer or sealer's authorized representative, which would be a deputy sealer or an inspector, would have come by and tested that pump for precision and accuracy. So it pumps out what it says it's going to pump. It has a tolerance that is met, which means it can be plus or minus a small amount, not very big amount. And it meets those tolerance requirements so that it can stay in service. It also has to meet requirements for the type of machine that measures the material coming out. It has to be what they call type approved, so that all gets inspected at the time that the sealers go out and check that pump. They also check to see if there are illegal devices inside of the recording software. So you've probably heard of skimmers. Mm-hmm. I believe they found several skimmers in Reading over their last number of years. And we haven't found any in Siskiyou County, but they have found some down in Shasta County. So they check for those also. Other things that sealers do is they check all the scales that are used in commerce. So if you measure, count, weigh, or whatever in commerce for sale, your machines have to be checked by a sealer, and they call it sealed when they pass the inspection. They put a little sticker on there that ensures that that's been checked at that point in time and that it was accurate and precise according to the regulations that, that apply to that. Again, it has to be type approved. So if I'm weighing, you know, a pound of hamburger for sale, for example, that scale's got to be accurate to plus or minus a couple divisions, which is not very much tolerance, small amount of tolerance, you know.
And how often does that have to be done?
So it happens once a year on a usual, although if there's a problem, the sealer has the right to do so as needed to ensure that it's being maintained in its proper activity. Mm. So for example, somebody's scale is typically off, doesn't meet tolerances, and there's some thought that maybe they're not doing it on purpose, the sealer can go back as many times as necessary to ensure that it gets dealt with correctly.
Oh.
And a sealer has a lot of power, actually. They can shut off the operation of anything that doesn't meet the requirements. They can, you know, write citations. We can do civil administrative penalties for infractions that we of the law. So we have some, you know, sticks to use in enforcing the law. But most of the time, sealers and ag commissioners are of the education first mode. Most people are trying to be honest and meet the rules, and we try to promote that. So if we have a problem, we work with the owners to correct it before any other type of action take place. We prefer to do that. So if you inform our constituents of the rules and regulations in all the arenas that we work in and help them to address them correctly, we have a lot less problems. And the public serve very well for that. You know?
Yeah, who knew the ag commissioner did that? All right, we have a lot of questions. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Jim Smith. He is from up in Siskiyou County. He is the ag commissioner. We're going to learn all about that.
A couple guys in first class on a flight from New York to Los Angeles. Kind of making small talk, killing time, flirting with the flight attendants. 30,000 feet above could be Oklahoma. Just a bunch of square cornfields and wheat farms, man, it all looks the same. Miles and miles of back roads and highways connecting little towns with funny names. Who'd want to live down there in the middle of nowhere? They've never drove through Indiana. Met the man who plowed that earth, planted that seed, busted his ass for you and me. You're caught a harvest moon in Kansas. They'd understand why I got made those flyover states. I bet that mile long Santa Fe.
Uptown got its hustlers. Bowery got it bumps. 42nd Street got Big Jim, a walker. He a bull-shooting son of a gun. Yeah, he'd
big and dumb as a man can come, but he's stronger than a country horse. And when the bad folks all get together at night, you know they all call Big Jim Ball just because. And they say you don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, you don't pull a mask off an old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim. I don't know that.
I was wondering. That's pretty good, I gotta admit.
I couldn't resist.
I'm not really that mean. I want you to know. You know?
I don't know. You know, you could.
Yeah, but you swing a mean pencil there when it comes to you know, straightening these scales and stuff out. So you actually take care of the scales at like the auction yard and place all scales in the county. Then.
Yes.
What about
yes.
like grocery stores and stuff? Those too.
Those too. Yeah.
Good so, Lord. If you live in a big city, do they have an ag commissioner in every county, I'm assuming?
They have an ag commissioner in most counties. There's a couple counties that are recruiting right now that haven't had one for a few years. I'm sure they're going to have those filled. And there's a couple counties that are so small that they combine them together.
Oh, that makes sense.
There's and about 53 or 4, maybe 55. I can't remember exactly. There's ag commissioners in the state of California. There's 57 counties, 58 counties, and so that's what the difference is. A few counties are combined into two. So, but they're
so even
small.
in like, you know, I mean, people wouldn't think you'd have an ag commissioner in San Francisco, for instance, but you would.
You'd have
because
to.
They're the sealer.
They have a ag commissioner who's a very, very responsible guy. His name is Cree, and he's a great guy. And he's weights and measures people, drive Priuses around town because they can't figure out how to park anywhere else. And they have a million scales to check along with the gas stations. And you
oh,
can imagine,
yeah. God, that's just.
Yeah, in a big city, I can just imagine how big a job that would be, just the scale part of it. Well, is that pretty much all the scaler does is certify the scales?
So the sealer certifies any weighing, measuring, counting, et cetera, device that's used in commerce for the protection of the public and to ensure that the rules are being met by the user of that product. So it's not just the scales. It's scales. It's dispensing material. It's something, if you go buy a length of rope and you have a machine that measures how many feet that is.
Home Depot or Lowe's or whatever.
And so if you measure wire, when you measure wire and it says you're going to pay for 10 foot of wire, that's gone through a sealed device that the company's using to measure that. So it's not a very well-known occupation. And, you know, most people have no idea that there's somebody in California looking over the shoulder of these people when they're measuring stuff to charge them for. They probably don't know that we also have responsibilities for, you know, package sales and development. We go into grocery stores and make a selection of materials, and then we make sure that what's read at the grocery store on these computer-controlled devices is accurate and reflects what's on the package. We also make sure that advertisements are met. So if they have a sale and you take the product to the, you know, front of the grocery store, for example, and it doesn't give you credit for the sale, you know, that's a violation and they have to correct that. So
you would take care of like these scanners that you when you scan a product and it says what it is and how much it is.
Because that's a scale too.
Well.
It weighs it.
Yeah. What about cash registers and that actually count your money? Because anymore, the checkers don't really count money anymore. They just push a button.
So we don't deal with that. That's a different department. I'm not sure which one that would be, though. But we are more concerned about the prices that are charged and the machine that determines that.
Right.
So it's nice and accurate. So I don't know how to address that other issue. I would mention one other thing. The state of California was in budget crunches several years ago, and several departments that we depended heavily upon were eviscerated in some respects. And weights and measures took a pretty big hit during that time. It lost a lot of expertise that was in Sacramento, who liaised with the county sealers. for training and expertise in areas that are specialists, which they have down in Sacramento. They're building it up back up a little bit, but some of the funding that came out for doing package inspections went away. So any kind of package inspection that we do right now is borne by the counties themselves.
Now, what's the county? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, some counties have a funding source for that. You know, counties that have a large degree of urban settings like San Francisco and L.A., for example. But that was a hard hit, but yeah. I mentioned it.
What is the what's the rule on, you know, like you walk into some of these mom-and-pop operations and you want to buy, 20 feet of rope, and they whip out a steel tape and measure off 10 feet and cut it off and give it to you. Is that legal, or, you know, what's the rule there?
Well, tape measure. Yeah, you would ask me a hard question.
I invited Bill nitpicker to sit in today.
The only reason I asked that is one in that situation is near and dear to my own heart. I mean, we actually do that in certain situations in our business.
In the tractor business, you have to measure hoses and different things
like that, and we don't have like an official scale.
So technically, you take your tape measure in to the ag commissioner, and he'll seal it for you. Certify that it's accurate and it meets the requirements for tolerance. So if it's plus or minus a percentage of an inch or something, then you're fine. Okay. But technically, that's any time you measure or weigh something, the device that you're using to do that with has got to be checked by the sealer.
Okay.
You know, so the impacts that has are sometimes considered by sealer, depending on his staffing and his ability to spend time. So if you're measuring out 10 foot of rope periodically, not on a pretty regular basis, that might be a low priority for enforcement activities, as opposed to a gas station that might be under pumping, half of a gallon or something every time you fill your car up.
Right.
Those types of things get a lot more attention. And I can tell you that we spend a lot of time checking those things to make sure that they're as accurate as possible. And most stations are pretty careful about that. They monitor that stuff themselves. And it's kind of remarkable when you find something that's out of sync. And usually that's related to, a pump failing or the measuring device failing.
Right.
And so they get them fixed. They get taken out of service and then put back in service. So people that work on these devices that we're talking about to weigh, measure, count, or whatever in commerce are called service agents. And they have to be licensed by the state of California to operate in each arena that they operate. So if they're working on gas pumps, they have to be certified for working on gas pumps. The service agents can actually go to an established pump or scale or whatever and fix it and place it back into service. They have to notify the sealer within 24 hours when they do that, so that we are informed that they've worked on it, and two, that it's been placed into service as an accurate device. And then we can go double check it when we have time to do so.
Oh, okay, so they don't really have the authority to certify it after they work on it, because I can see where you go out and fix a gas pump and it's running, but it may not be pumping at exactly the rate that it's supposed to be. So that has to be recertified then once they work on it.
Well, actually, the service agent will be very careful about making sure it meets the specs, because when we go look at it, if it's out of compliance, we're going to shut it off. And so a service agent's business is to keep his customers' pumps in operation and keep the buying public in there. So they're really careful about making sure that the devices are accurate and precise before they leave. They're very careful about that. And most of the time, they're quite competent. Usually, we have very few problems with devices that get placed back into service from a repair that they do. And they're pretty on the spot, Johnny, on the spot, as far as letting us know within that 24-hour window that they've done work on something like that. Sometimes, though, they replace the device with a new one. And in a new case, the tolerances are very much smaller for a brand new device. They have to meet a tighter specification in order to get approved. Mm. And they can't use them in the channels of trade in commerce unless they've been sealed by a sealer. So the brand new device, say a gas pump, for example, or a diesel pump, has to be sealed prior to first use when it gets initially put into place.
Wow.
And so sometimes, it gets to be a little bit of a scheduling nightmare, especially for some counties that have a lot of gas stations. So in L.A., they have a ton of sealers or deputy sealers that just do, fuel pumps, the gas pumps. That's all they do. That's
you can't even imagine.
Yeah, all day long for years, for their whole career, they do that. But they're pretty good at it. So they have, up-to-date equipment for measuring that. So I might address that, too. Everything we use to seal devices, whether it's a weight or we measure something or, we even lay out mile-long runs for taxi cab meters to make sure that they're accurate and precise. They're still working on Uber and Lyft certifications right now at the Sacramento office. They're learning how to measure hydrogen for hydrogen cars. They're trying to work on developing, meters for electric cars. Currently, most of them don't charge yet. But as things progress, we're going to start seeing some new devices added to our list of required, measuring devices.
So oddly enough, as the Ag Commissioner, you're in a very forward, you wind up in a very forward position. I was looking at the bio. We've got to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we're going to shift a little bit to agriculture, the actual ag part. But it says here on the county website, the purpose is to protect the environment and the citizens of the county through our environmental and natural resource protections, consumer industry protection, air quality, and animal control programs. And then you add the whole sealer thing. I mean, this is a pretty comprehensive job.
A pretty busy job.
Who knew what you guys were out there doing? All right, we're going to be back with Jim Smith, the Ag Commissioner up in Siskiyou County.
One thing you should always find. You got to saddle up your boys. You got to draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune. And we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men. Beer for my horses.
There's a for sale sign on a big old rusty tractor. You can't miss it. It's the first thing that you see. Just up the road, a pale blue water tower with I Love Jenny painted in bright green. Hey, that's my Bill there by the courthouse. He'll be lowering the flag when the sun goes down. And this is my town.
Yeah, this is my town. Hey, where I was born, where I was raised, where I keep all my yesterdays. Where I ran off cause I got mad and it came to blows with my own. This is my town. Yeah, this is my town. My town.
There you go, Jim. Little shout out. Little shout out for Tule Lake there. I don't know why. It just reminded me of Tule Lake.
Yeah, it does. It does. Tule Lake has some major challenges up there.
And they do. They absolutely do. So I had somebody ask me, why we weren't doing a show about the fire, and I thought, well, we already had the Ag Commissioner scheduled, and really the reason in part that we wind up with these fires is lack of management of our forests that surround our rural areas. Obviously not your issue necessarily, like here, National Park, and they've just hugged the trees to the point where, well, they're all gone now. But you guys have the same problem up where you are. I think all of us are comprised of large swaths of public land And, you know, the environmental policy has been, let's let it overgrow. And
it's natural.
It's supernatural. And it puts our towns at risk. And like up by the Tule Lake, up in the northeast part of your county, you have juniper that's been allowed to really overgrow and uses a ton of water. So in an area that's always needs more water.
50 gallons per day on a juniper tree all year long, according to the USDA APHIS research in Burns, Oregon. In Burns, Oregon, they've done studies on watersheds that supported removal of juniper trees and found that springs that had been long dried, that you know, had a history of 100 years of never going dry, started flowing again when they removed the junipers from the watershed. So,
holy cow.
Very, a lot of truth to that. The environmental impacts are definitely great up here. I think that major problems that we're looking at here relate to environmental interests promoting no management of forests, recreational interests promoting recreational interest only. Loggers are few and far between. They have no impact on policymakers. So most of the power is in the hands of the people, you know, and if they don't understand the relationship between these massive wildfires and the lack of the Forest Service of both state and federal levels to manage the forest because of the conflicts of interest, we're going to see more and more of these types of activities happening. Currently, the harvest management programs are pretty much few and far between. Even in salvage areas where fire has gone through and killed, you know, thousands of acres of trees, the Forest Service will attempt to market that and get somebody to come in and salvage log that. And another group will take them to court and challenge that sale based upon some purpose that they have in mind. And by the time it's out of court and the sale can proceed, which is not always the case, sometimes it's forbidden, the wood is no longer good because fungus has grown in it and it's deteriorated to a point where it can't make satisfactory lumber.
Oh, yeah, we've seen that a lot.
Firewood. Yeah, lots. Tons of that stuff happens. That's happened a lot up here. We have this program of prescribed burns that the Forest Service and CAL FIRE, the state fire people try to minimize the undergrowth, underbrush issues and remove all that extra fire material, but that's not as effective by any means as a logging program is. And I know a lot of people think that logging is like old-fashioned stuff, but you know, people that live in houses, where do they think their trees are coming from? The other thing they should keep in mind is that one of my major professors at Chico is a molecular biologist. And also, he's a humble forester. How about that, Aaron?
Mm-hmm.
And he has some Science Foundation grants that measure the growth and development of ponderosa pines under high CO2 levels. And in most cases, a very healthy CO2 sink is a very vigorous growing national forest system. A bunch of pines and firs out there growing vigorously, which mean they're younger, soak a lot of carbon up out of the environment. And when it's harvested and put into a house, you know, you're looking at 100 or 200 years of carbon tie up there, if not longer, because most houses last quite a while before they recycle that lumber into something else. And oftentimes, you know, that gets recycled into another house. So really, big help to some of the CO2 issues that we have today would be both logging of forests and replanting of vigorously growing new forests, replacing the ones that are burned up and also the ones that hopefully would get logged. Now, it's been my experience that a lot of money is set aside at the national level for replanting. Unfortunately, because of the management of the wood, this is all my opinion, of course. Just want to reiterate that.
Well, we already had a really long disclaimer at the beginning, so we can pretty much say anything we want. And
oh, good. Yeah. Most of this stuff is my opinion, but you start, you know, stopping logging and managing for fire, which is what we're doing currently. And I'm not laying blame at anybody's door. Just there's a lot of buying interest. That there's a lot of buying interests that actually achieve that goal. And so they all burn up. And then all the money gets spent on fighting fire, right?
Yep.
They don't spend it on replanting because they have to steal it out of the budget and fight the fire. So there's nothing left. So the Forest Service, for example, is going bankrupt trying to keep track of all the expenses for fighting fire in the West mostly. And they don't have any money left over to replant wildfire burnt forests. I don't know if anybody knows that.
No, that's that's a great point. We got to take a break, but when we come back,
not yet.
Oh, we don't?
No.
No.
That's why you're not in charge of breaks.
Well, 2 minutes. I got a quick story.
We have to take a break. Sorry, we got to go now.
There was a article, I believe it was in Range Magazine here a year or two ago, about the reforestation of Mount St. Helens. And we all know when that thing went off, it destroyed millions of acres of forest up there, much of which was Weyerhaeuser land and the rest was Forest Service land. Forest Service elected to let the natural growth reforest the area. Weyerhaeuser went in, and I forget how many millions and millions of board feet of lumber they took out of that of their property, and then went in and replanted. Today, if you go over and look at an aerial shot of that area, the Weyerhaeuser land is a thriving forest again, and the Forest Service land is pretty much barren. It's just a mess, and they have actually admitted now that that whole letting nature take its course is the wrong way to do it. We have to go back in and take the dead wood out and replant.
Well, I was reading a thing from a very well-respected forester at the national level, and he had said that really at the rate we're going with the type of programs that we have and all the environmental lawsuits and all the stuff that's going on, in 40 years, we will not have forests. We just won't have them.
No, they'll be gone. They'll be burned up.
They'll just be moonscapes. So, you know, for the people that are still on the fence about whether or not, you know, cutting trees and managing them and keeping the catastrophic fires to a minimum and then eventually phasing them out. Yeah, well, they're kind of dopey because we're going to have nothing. You're going to go on vacation and look at zero. We'll be back with the Siskiyou County Ag Commissioner. His name is Jim Smith, and you're listening to We the People. Please join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Welcome back. You're joined in the second hour of We the People. If you missed the first hour or you would like to send this to a friend or you'd like a little extra information, we're posting stuff all the time about the show, things we're talking about here, wethepeopleradio.us. That's also where you can find contact information for us, and you can give us ideas for guests. I guess you could call and complain, but, you know, mostly if you need to complain, just change the channel. Yeah. That's why they have a disclaimer I see that disclaimer's kind of making
disclaimers for you.
It's kind of making me feel snarky.
Yeah, it's for you. Trust
I didn't
me.
Feel like that before they played the disclaimer.
Yeah.
Anyway, so my name's Aaron Ryan,
and I'm Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Team Power. Team Power is our local John Deere and Kubota tractor dealer. They're up on Twin View Boulevard, 3119, and they do everything tractors there. So if you have repairs or you need parts or service, whatever, give them a call at 226-9226 or get them online or on the web at readingtractors.com. That's Team Power.
See, Bill does a much better job on the commercial when I don't look at him. I was just trying that out.
Stop looking.
Did you notice how I didn't look at you?
She's looking at me. I remember that. Yeah.
So as long as I don't look at him, we're all good.
Yeah.
All right. So we're here with the Siskiyou County Ag Commissioner. And if you missed the first hour, you ought to listen because the little seals on the gas pumps, if you're curious who's in charge of that, ta-da, it's your Ag Commissioner. Go figure. So we learned a lot about those kinds of things. How are things weighed, you know, when stores have little bags of things for sale and they say it weighs a certain amount? How do you know?
Yeah.
But the Ag Commissioner knows.
Somebody's got an eye on them.
Mm-hmm.
Trust me.
Somebody's watching. So that was interesting. That's stuff that I think most people would not know. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the forest situation in light of the local fires that we have all of the time. But I don't want to run out of time before we discuss the Klamath Project and some of the things with, like, the dam removal and all that. And the reason we're focusing on Siskiyou County in particular is you can't really talk about these issues about the entire western states. I mean, that's silly. Every place has its own stuff. But if you really look at the issues in Siskiyou County, they apply in a lot of other places. If you can figure out what's going on there, you will start to see it in other places. And honestly, they've got more issues than anywhere I know all at the same time.
Well, I think a lot of it is because they are rural. Wrong. Most of it is a rural community, and they're easy pickings.
I know. They're just under the gun, but boy, they're fighters, which is something that the government guys and the environmentalists have found wholly annoying, which is fantastic.
Yeah, they don't lay down for you.
Keep up the good work up there. So, Jim, since you come from the Tule Lake Basin up there, you want to give people a little kind of primer, and then what it's going to do, you know, we've had this lawsuit pending where they're going to shut off all the water to all the ag, you know, some numbers on how much is grown up there and all that. And if they shut all that off, what does that do to the county? Because these have real world impacts in the economy, not to mention the fact that on a wider scale, everyone's food prices go up and there are shortages. Ultimately, we drive out all our farmers, there's nothing to eat.
I'd be glad to talk about that. I am kind of personally involved in that. I own, as do my family, own about 400 or 500 acres in the Tule Lake Irrigation District, part of the Klamath Project. So a little history. The Klamath Project was a Bureau of Reclamation water management project that was designed to supply farmers with both irrigation water and farmland in the Klamath Basin. Klamath Basin is a interstate watershed that encompasses areas in Klamath County, Oregon, and Modoc and Siskiyou counties in California. It also was designed to supply waters to the Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuge and Lower Klamath National Wildlife Refuge in cooperation with the Klamath Project operation. There's about 225,000 acres of active farmland throughout the Klamath Project. About 80,000 acres were recovered by draining a portion of Lower Klamath Lake and Tule Lake. Tule Lake and parts of Lower Klamath Lake were landlocked lakes. So it was, geologically speaking, would have turned into something similar to the Great Salt Lake over time. They didn't have any outlets for the water, so the salts would have continued to accumulate in there, and as a irrigation district moves tailwater out of there and through the refuges and back into the Klamath River, it's removed that potential. So farmers in the project area, which is about 225,000 acres or 255,000 acres actually, they raise barley, wheat, oats, alfalfa grass, hay, cereal grain hay, potatoes. They raise strawberry nursery plants. They raise dehydrator onions, ones that are used to make, you know, onion powder, very strong flavored high solid content onion. They raise mint, mostly peppermint. They raise horseradish. This is the capital of the horseradish, the western capital of horseradish production in Siskiyou and Modoc counties. We also have a small micro green lettuce production level, and there's some carrots and carrot seed production in the county. So they have somewhat of a diverse, in the Klamath Project, diverse growing habit over there. So the Klamath Basin is on the Pacific Flyway, and the Klamath Basin National Wildlife Refuges Complex is there at Tule Lake, and it's visited by migratory game birds every year at big, big numbers. However, without water in the refuges, it creates havoc down south because if they stop here and eat and fill up on the grain that is left behind by the farmers, and they have co-op leases along the edges of both refuges to provide food as part of the rent. They have to leave up to a third or more of their crop as the lease payment for some of these co-op leases to feed that migratory game. And if they can keep them out of the rice fields down south until a little bit later after they've harvested, it lessens that conflict between the rice farmers and the migratory wildfowl. And it works out well for them because what happens when you harvest is that you put out the back end of a combine, anything that's too small to market, they dump it back on the ground. And the geese come back in and snap that up. And it's pretty good food when they're getting ready to go south.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know they were required to do that. That's
only on some of the leases. Okay, those are the co-op leases. There are two kinds of leases in the leased lands. So we'll talk about that as a separate subject. So the Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuge has, by law, Kekal Act passed in 1964. Been required to lease out a percentage of their refuge. 16,000 acres is included. About 13,000 acres actually gets farmed and moved into programs called walking wetlands, where they flood a large segment of the leased lands for 2, 3, 4 years, and it becomes wetland habitat, marsh habitat, and then they take it out of production and move that wetland into another area, which cleans it up, and the growers can go in and farm that, and all the nematodes and diseases that affect some of the more profitable crops in there can be raised organically without any pesticides, which is a big push in the leased lands to move toward organic production. So in the leased lands, rents are high. It's the most productive ground in the Klamath Project. And it pretty much pays for its own regulatory self. They take it out of the lease payments. The lease payments support a pesticide enforcement program that my county, my people, perform on a seven-day-a-week basis, doing inspections of pesticide applications in the lease land, where they enforce buffer zones and pesticide use requirements that was developed by a pesticide use committee. Pesticide use program that's developed by a committee of fish and wildlife officials, the Bureau of Reclamation officials, many who are experts in fish and wildland birds and invertebrate pets, and are experts in toxicology of chemicals. And they set up a separate guideline for the use of pesticides on the leased land, evaluating first and foremost the safety for the wildlife that inhabit the refuge. And secondly, on its effectiveness as a agricultural tool. And so we enforce those rules along with all the California state and federal rules of the use of pesticides on the leased land.
So is the leased land, is it profitable to go in and farm that? I mean, when you look at having to return, a third of the crop back to nature and then the pesticide reductions, how can that be profitable to farm?
So, Bill, only a partial, a number of the leases are called co-op leases, okay? And they are regulated to raising grain. They don't have any options for that because they need the bird feed for the migratory wildfowl. And so the grain is profitable enough to encourage people to do that every year. I've never seen any, you know, idle.
Right.
I'm not going to say they get rich on that, but evidently it must be profitable enough to keep them doing that.
Lucrative enough that somebody will lease it.
Yeah, the rest of it is leased out based upon a bid, a cash bid for rent. And so the Bureau of Reclamation at the beginning of the year will put out a bid for the leases that are up, you know, for grabs. And the high bid takes it. Part of that money goes to administering that program by the Bureau of Reclamation for the Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Part of it goes to administering the program that I'm in, which means the pesticide enforcement and inspection program that we do. And all that is also used to support an in lieu of tax payments for Siskiyou County. Siskiyou County gets a percentage, and Modoc and Klamath counties all get a percentage of the income from that in lieu of taxes. It's a pretty substantial amount. In fact, it's enough of an amount that would be a serious hit to our coffers if it went away. And there's a group of people that would like to see all that ground taken away from commercial farm production. In defense of that, though, having grown up there, I've seen a lot of wildfowl eat leftover potatoes, leftover grain, leftover onions. They've grazed on the grass fields for hay, and they've grazed on the alfalfa fields for food, you know. So it's kind of a benefit to both the farmers and to the wildfowl that inhabits refuge.
Yet again, one of those issues you have to actually have some information before you make a decision. And usually the people that are against it and want to change it don't know those things.
We have
to take
story.
A really, really quick break again, and we're going to come right back with Jim Smith. He is the Ag Commissioner in Siskiyou County. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Some have said down through history, if you last, it's a mystery. But I guess they don't know what they're talking about. From the mountains down to the sea, you become such a habit with me. America, America. Well, I come from down round Tennessee, but the people in California are nice to me. America. Don't matter where I may roam, tell you people that it's home sweet home. America, America.
The country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. And we can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
We're going to make sure of it, because without us, the city folks are doomed, and we all know that. So, Jim, what kind of I don't know how we want to go about this, but give us some numbers, like on the amount of production, what kind of money that is, and what happens if to the county. If they were to actually just shut down the Klamath project and turn it back into nothingness.
So So, Aaron, the environmental groups that I talk to have a plan to turn this into the Everglades of the West. You ever heard of that?
Okay, well, that's a nightmare.
That's a nightmare. They're trying to turn back the clock on the whole Klamath project and turn it back into a what they perceive as a sustainable marsh and wetland.
Of course.
Okay. But that doesn't work too well. So Siskiyou County's total production in agricultural revenues is between $350 million and, you know, close to $300 million. It varies according to prices and productivity. In 2017, I believe our total was $277 million, $278 million. Of that, about $88 million was $88 million was from Tule Bay, basically. So the value of the farm products in the project is great compared to the number of acres. So again, the Tule Lake Irrigation District encompasses about 66,000 acres. 63,000 are farmed, and 63,000 acres out of the total production of the Siskiyou County agriculture is a small percentage. So a small percentage generates a very large revenue source. All that revenue contributes to, you know, of course, property tax base for the county. And they have personal property tax on their equipment, all those things. If they shut the water off, personal property taxes on the land will probably be reduced from 5,000 actual value on average to about 1,000. And so you'd be looking at a pretty severe reduction. Of course, that wouldn't translate directly across the board, but it would have a major impact. Other impacts of shutting the water off completely in that project, which I should describe that the project is fed by water from Upper Klamath Lake. And originally, water rights were given to each of the homesteaders, and all the homesteaders were veterans of World War I, II. The first set of settlers were World War I vets, and they settled mostly on the west side of the project, and the World War II vets settled a little bit later on more on the east side. The water coming out of Klamath Lake is fed through an irrigation system that has been deemed one of the most efficient irrigation systems in the world. It's about 80% efficient when it comes to using the water that you get and reclaiming the tail water and moving it back into the river.
And just so for people who don't do agricultural speak, tail water is the runoff. Literally, at runoff the tail water. of the use, it goes on to do something else.
Yeah, and it gets used quite a few times before it gets into the refuges. The refuges are a kind of a sink for it, and then of course excess is moved off into the Klamath River. And we've also, as part of that project, they diverted some of the waters from Lost River, which used to be a sink into the Tule Lake Basin and never went anywhere, back into the Klamath River, which it never used to go to. And so during periods of high flow, the Klamath River benefits from that extra water flowing down there too. That hasn't been the case in drought years for quite some time. The refuge struggles to get enough water to provide for their wildlife management. And the farmers are struggling continually with the environmental groups who are challenging their use of the water out of Klamath Lake. So some of the lawsuits and biological opinions that have occurred in the last 10 years since 2001 when they shut it off illegally and then refused to pay for it. Every single farmer in the basin was shut right off without any notice whatsoever. And the court found that that was illegal, but they never awarded any damages for that. But we can talk about that later.
Big shock.
The current situation has been that it's a drought situation. This year, the lake was clear full of water, although we were having issues with snowpack and some of those things. But due to a biological opinion, it requires a controversial flushing flow to remove parasites from the Klamath River. There's actually been no evidence that it's very successful. And even several years ago, when we had flood stage waters in the river, they were going to release 50,000 acre feet of additional flow down the Klamath River to comply with that biological opinion of a flush flow. And it would have flooded out all those towns in the south of the Klamath, like Klamath, the town of Klamath. It would have been underwater probably if the Board of Supervisors here in Siskiyou County hadn't stepped up and kind of told them, well, we'll send you the bill. And so they rescinded that. They did a good job of protecting the constituents down there. But can you imagine that? Actually, at flood stage, turning more water into the river.
For the fish, right?
Yeah, for the fish.
Yeah.
Well, to flush the parasites out. So if the parasites get flushed out, you would think that a flood flow, natural flow, would probably take care of that, right? Evidently, it didn't or doesn't. So you kind of wonder what that water is used for in the first place. So here's the situation this year. We have a drought. We have numerous lawsuits ongoing. We have a biological opinion that supports this flush flow. Judge Orrick down in San Francisco filed an injunction against releasing any water to farmers or anybody else until after that flush flow had been garnered. The project, the Klamath Project, has family farmers on it. You know, we're not talking about Fresno County where some of those farms are 30,000, 40,000 acres, and they're kind of big corporate giants down there. These guys are family farmers. You know, they have wives and kids working on the farm, and they have long-term employees that are part of the family practically, and they raise a multitude of crops. They're pretty progressive, and they're struggling to stay in business. And so they shut the water off with an injunction by Judge Orrick in San Francisco. So when you usually water onions, for example, they get planted in April, which are a contract crop, by the way. So I agree to raise, you know, a couple hundred acres of these contracted onions, these dehydrator onions, to ship to your factory down there so you can make, you know, powder, onion powder, or flakes or whatever. And they need it to keep their factory running. And then this judge shuts it off, and then they don't have any water to irrigate into their onions. They're a little dinky seed. I mean, everybody's planted onions in their garden probably. As soon as the wind blows, if you've planted, I mean, it blows them right out of the ground. So there wasn't any water to irrigate with except for areas around the edges that might have a little groundwater. And so April, the first day of irrigation usually in the system, was dry the whole month of April. The month of May was going to be dry, but Pacific Power, who has a water right to run some of the power producing dams in the Klamath River, actually drained Copco Lake to keep the water flow in the Klamath River at the required biological levels, and diverted some small amount of water from Klamath Lake into the irrigation system's ditches. So that was about 17,000 acre feet. So give you some perspective. The project usually in the past used 400,000 acre feet of water that irrigated all of the ground, and it met all the needs of the diverse kinds of crops that we raise. A biological opinion and a judge after the water cut off in 2001 required that the Klamath Project would have to come up with 100,000 acre feet of alternative water sources and restricted the allocation from the Klamath Lake to 300,000 acre feet. So that cut us down to 300,000 acre feet out of the lake. And you divide that by our short growing season, which is about 4 months, 110 days. You know, that's what, 50,000 acre feet per month, about. something like that, 40,000, 50,000 acre feet a month. So we've already lost practically 50,000 and 20 or 30,000.
And just 80, in case anybody was thinking, this water that had to happen to get rid of this parasite in the river. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll let you know if that actually worked. I think you'll be super excited about the answer. I know I was. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. All right, Jim, just for the sake of planning, told you we'd run out of time. We've got 25 minutes and we have one break to squeeze in between now and then.
Oh, I know you're like hours.
I know you're like 2 hours. It's just going to, what are we going to talk about? I'm like, it's going to go really
fast.
It's
going to fly by.
You know, this always happens. It's not that we can't do a second program, actually. We could just carry over.
Yeah,
we could hold you hostage for a different week. Like, next week, we could do next week.
Yeah, I'm game for that. If your listeners are interested, it'd be quite a opportunity for me to share other things about Siskiyou County's, issues.
I think it's important for people to understand, and I realize, again, it's one place, but we've done a lot of shows about Siskiyou County, actually, but the policy problems, not created by the local people, but this whole interplay between state and federal government and the environmental community and all this, you guys are like the bullseye of
this. Well, they're the front lines.
If it
comes crashing down there, they head right on to the next county.
I've always believed that if they could roll the people in Siskiyou County and get away with all this crap, everybody else is doomed.
Everybody else is doomed.
You guys are the best resistance out there. Thank goodness most of your right wingers, because I got to tell you, if you were the left and you actually applied the resistance to the resistance, we'd be in trouble.
But we need to get on to the
dams and all that, and I know we can't do that in 20 minutes. So, okay, you'll be our hostage next week, so no panic. We'll just chat along, and when we run out, we'll continue.
Okay, I'm game for that. All right. I do have a little, synopsis here.
Okay.
So the Klamath project's about a $557 million industry. And when you consider that for every dollar that's earned in agricultural production, you get a 91 cents back that's reinvested in the community, developed in the community. So instead of $557 million, you almost have twice that. It's almost $1 billion, right? And the output multiplier. We're talking about infrastructure, like small businesses and manufacturers that support agriculture in the area. And in cases of jobs, for example, in the project, there's 4,500 jobs or 5,200 jobs in the ag sector, and it generates another 0.6 of a job. So you're looking at another 5,200 almost jobs that are created in the community that support the agriculture areas out there.
With a county population of what? What's your county population?
I can't remember
okay.
that.
Okay, continue on. I'll find that. Okay. I should know that off the top of my pointer head, and I just forgot.
I should know that, too. That's kind of embarrassing. I don't know that.
Well, not really. We don't need it very often.
It's not very high.
Nope.
You know, Klamath County has
45,000. We've got Ashley. Ashley's like our rain man right now.
Definitely. Thank you, Ashley.
That's Ashley. Look up the impact of Klamath County and Modoc County populations, too. They're both rather small, you know. These are all small rural counties. In case it takes about 2 hours to drive across Siskiyou County or three, depending on which roads you get. So it's probably rather large. It's one of the largest counties in California. Most of it's owned by the federal government, of course.
Yep.
And so, you know, what we're looking at here is, conflicts of government ideals. One is Endangered Species Act issues, which currently Klamath River has, a salmon that's considered endangered. And lake,
that I can buy at Costco, by the way.
Yeah, from, yeah, I won't tell you from what. So, yeah, so, the, you know, we have water that's been tied up to protect the coho fish downstream, and we have water tied up now in the Klamath Lake to support suckerfish. And there's a lot of controversy surrounding science because, you know, it's being developed right now. Nobody really knows anything. And, the tribe is adamant about having their food source maintained and not go extinct, which they claim in their last.
But nobody eats the suckerfish because they taste like dirt. Isn't that true?
If you've ever had any fish out of Klamath Lake, they tell you to only catch them in the spring, early spring, and at the mouth of the Wood River. Otherwise, they taste kind of like dirt. Yes. And I've never tasted one out of Klamath Lake that was tasted very well. So, yes, they do. They taste like dirt. Klamath Lake is in its last stages of life. You know, I don't know how to say it. Eutrophic lake in the last stages of growth. It's filling in. It's shallow. It's warm. It's full of blue-green algae, and running that water downstream to help a cold water season fishery is kind of
counterintuitive.
Well, it seems kind of counterintuitive. Some of the tributaries that flow in there are cold water, but Klamath Lake is definitely not that. So what's happened is that the conflicts between government required Endangered Species Act protections and power plays by tribes with treaty rights that go back to, 1864, have come to a head, and it's put the Klamath Project landowners into a pinch. They're going to probably, I can't say that, but the likelihood without water of survival of any of those farmers up there or any of those communities that are in those areas is very grim. We still have a lawsuit. We had the water turned off early in the year for 2 months. We had a small amount allocated by the Pacific Power, which helped a few growers, but not very many. And then the Bureau turned the water on in June. That's 60 days after the start of a 110-day growing season. If you're a farmer and you've lost, 60 days out of a 110-day growing season, that's not very good, is it? That's almost half of your growing season.
That's a real risk at that point to plant and get a crop off in time. It's disastrous. So
these guys are hoping for a long season. Long fall, long warm season to maybe help size the products that they put in the ground. There's quite a bit of ground that is fallow this year because they were afraid to plant it. But there's been a lot of stuff that they went ahead and planted it, and they were praying that they would have enough water to irrigate. So there's about 2,000 irrigators and families there, and they don't have a water right that goes back to time immemorial, but they do have a vested interest in there. They're third, fourth generation farmers and ranchers there that were promised, their ancestors were promised adequate water to irrigate there. That's why they settled there, and that's their heritage also. So So it's not just the tribes and the coho species and all those things that are on the chopping block. We're talking about whole communities of taxpayers and families that have been living there for generations.
Who have water rights, which are in effect property rights.
Yeah. What's
so this is kind of like, well, we're going to take away part of your house and give it to somebody else.
Take all your house away from you.
And in some cases, by the way, you get to live in somebody else's house because we're going to take yours.
Well, yeah, they've been doing this for 100 years. So you know, what's changed to make this all of a sudden a crisis that they have to have all the water?
Before we start that, let's take the last break so we don't cut it off too close to the top of the hour. And we'll be back with the Siskiyou County Ag Commissioner, Jim Smith. And we're running out of time, so we're going to tell you that now. But he's agreed to come back next week so we can finish up all the things we didn't talk about. And you're listening to We the People. You can join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, the eagle's been flying slow, and the flag's been flying low, and a lot of people saying that America's fixing to fall. But speaking just for me and some people from Tennessee, we got a thing or two to tell you all. This lady may have stumbled, but she ain't never failed. And if the Russians don't believe that, they can all go straight to hell. We're gonna put her feet back on the path of righteousness, and then God bless America again. And you never did think that it ever would happen again. In America, did you? You never did think that we'd ever get together again. We're damn sure good, you were walking real proud, and we're talking real loud again. In America, you never did think that it ever would happen again.
Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I fell
into like that song. A burning ring of fire. I don't like it as much anymore.
No, it's too close to home now.
Literally. So I thought we'd throw that out there for the car fire. And it's C-A-R-R fire because it's the car powerhouse, even though it was started kind of by a vehicle. It was a trailer, but it's not the car. The reason it has two R's, it's not about an actual driving car.
Well, yeah, and I think it happened right there near the car powerhouse.
Right.
Turnoff.
Correct.
Where it started.
So that's why it has two R's. I've had people ask me, why do they keep misspelling the word car? Okay. It has geographic significance here. That's why they used it for the name. So, Jim, we had somebody call during the break, wanted to know why we don't just dredge the lake up there.
Well, that's a really good question. The dredging could probably generate an income source from the organic matter that they could use for potting soil. Every time that was brought up as a faculty research assistant for Oregon State University's Climate Experiment Station, which, you know, we had a lot of smarter people than I am that worked there, including my boss, Dr. Ken Reichquist. They thought that it would be impossible to overcome the sediment deposits that are continually coming into that lake at this late stage of its growth. However, I don't know if anybody's really looked into that close enough to say that. I have a lot of respect for the opinions of my peers there, but if you put a concerted effort in there and spent one-tenth of the money that's been spent on the suckerfish research since the U.S. Geological Service's biological research team moved into Klamath, we probably would have had that lake dredged to 500 feet deep, I can imagine. Mm-hmm. Spent an enormous amount of money studying the suckerfish and its habitat. We have some growers that are actually raising suckerfish juveniles into a bigger size and then release them back into the lake to try to address number issues. There's a lot of controversy surrounding everything about this whole controversy, this conflict.
We have controversy about our controversy.
Yeah, no,
and that's true.
So, for example, there's a lot of research early on that indicated that during drought years, the survival and and retention of juvenile suckerfish were enhanced by drought seasons when the water levels were extremely low. And that's pretty well documented. My boss, Dr. Ken Reichbos, at that time, when they were discussing this after the U.S. Geological Service got put into place, documented all that information and presented it in a paper. And he was ostracized. The Klamath tribe went to Oregon State University and laid political pressure on pretty thick, and the Oregon State University admin at that time disavowed Dr. Reichbost and his work.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. He was a long-term researcher that had, different from their claims, a pretty good background in both fisheries and hydrology, water science. And he knew what he was talking about. He's a pretty smart guy.
He tried to use actual facts, which, of course, would make him a blasphemer.
Yeah, so he became persona non grata at the Oregon State University admin level. That really hurt his heart. It was an unfortunate incident in his career, which was, remarkable. Anyway, that's just some of the stuff that goes on. You can't argue with a treaty, award that goes back to 1864, but the method of calling for water right now that tribe has placed has impacted a lot of places. So the Upper Sprague River in Klamath County, Oregon, has immediately dried up. No water can be taken out of any of the rivers and streams feeding into Klamath Lake. And so that dried up all the ranchers up in the north of Klamath County. So they can't irrigate their pastures or their hay fields. And it actually impacted Crater Lake National Park. They had to quit taking water out of their normal stream flow, which was adequate to, feed the Crater Lake National Park visitors. They were curtailed from that. So they started buying water from the city of Chiloquin. Well, the water master shut off the city of Chiloquin's main water wells because it was too close to the river. And as such, the Klamath tribe shut off all the drinking water in Chiloquin. They did offer to allow them to use water from a storage tank that they had in a well nearby in replacement of that, and complained that they didn't ask for any help, the city of Chiloquin. Chiloquin went back to the Department of Water Quality in Oregon and asked for a stay of execution, which it was granted. And I think it's expiring at the end of July, 31st. So they went back to the tribes recently, according to a Herald News article I just read, and asked if they would still honor their claim that was made publicly and give them water out of the storage tanks and allow them to use some of their well water that they had. And the tribe has refused that request currently. So, they're trying to figure out how to drill a new well with grants that they're trying to achieve. And I don't know what they're going to do on July 31st. And I don't know what Crater Lake National Park is going to do either. So there's a
wow,
a little bit of a power crazy play going on there.
And, we should mention, for people who don't know the area, that historically Klamath Lake went almost all the way dry. It was just down to, the mud flats, and the suckerfish survived in that, which is why they taste like dirt. But they survived in that, and one benefit of that is that all the predators died every year. So then when the rains came, filled the lake up, the suckerfish were bigger than they were the year before, and they could fend off all the predators. Well, this new magical faux science of keeping more water in the lake has allowed the predators to actually breed, grow, and develop. So now the population of the suckerfish is dwindling, but no one can figure out why.
Well, you said the the flushing of the parasites, that didn't work or did work? We were going to talk about that.
Yeah, well, as far as I know, any research documentation that supports that hasn't come up with any positive information. Of course, they're going to have a 5-year study to come up with that. And we're going to have to evaluate what's happening in the ocean off the coast, which nobody seems to talk about.
No, we don't want to talk about that. Yeah, the ocean—the ocean has no bearing on whether or not fish come back. It all happens 190 miles away up in Klamath.
That's right. And so there's also the fact that in the past, when there wasn't any dams in the river, the Klamath Lake would dry up the river. It would be dry in the summer.
Correct.
And the Link River would be dry. It's all rocks. So
the salmon walked up there. I mean, every year.
They had little shoes and suitcases, and they carried little bags on their back. Little bike riders, and they drank that way.
Yeah.
So it's rather interesting to see which dams they're willing to take out, which dams they're not willing to take out. So it's kind of interesting. So I have another story that pertains to that, too. My family homesteaded in the Chico, California area along the Sacramento River and what is now known as Llano Seco Ranch or Pere Grant Ranch. And along with a lot of other people, they homesteaded and planted orchards and raised truck crops down there. And then the Spanish land grabs were upheld in California court. They got kicked off the ground. So I guess I come from a long line of squatters. It's what it amounts to. Okay?
People just want to run you off.
Yeah. But my family's kept records over the years. You know, the Smith clan's pretty productive. They've had 7 or 12 kids for like 3 or 4 generations down there, the records indicate that it was common to walk across the river, the Sacramento River, in August. It was, you just wade across it. It wasn't very deep at all. Currently, I go down and go fishing with a fishing outfit for salmon in the fall run of August, that we are required to maintain that flow for that salmon run in August. So you start thinking about how often that gets done in the West as far as salmon runs and salmon and water flows, required water flows are going. So that's a false water flow most of the time. And it's being maintained by law that instead of wading across Sacramento River, I have to have enough water in there for a fall August run of salmon, which I like catching salmon, but it takes a lot of water to keep the fish running up. So without Shasta Dam, what would happen?
The dams, I mean, we put them in for a reason. We spent massive amounts of money back in the day. We should talk a little bit next week about the volume of government that is running the Klamath Project. I mean, this isn't just a bunch of farmers, hanging out, having a fight with the local tribe about who gets the water and whether the fish that tastes like dirt need more of it.
That's right.
I just can't include that enough. We're out of time again. We're in the last
Need to talk about what a county ag commissioner really does.
We're going to hit that. Yeah. We can hit that next week.
We're doing all that. So you have you have seven days to prepare, and we will Skype with you next Sunday at noon, and we'll chat some more about all of this fun stuff. And I've got things to add to the website you sent me this morning that I still haven't done. So
great.
We'll be back with our guest Jim Smith next week. He is the Siskiyou County Ag Commissioner, and you're going to love it and learn a lot. You've been listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.